what I've done. He just looks at me like I should know. I can't keep twisting myself around, hoping something will finally satisfy him. Beauvoir's a great investigator and a good man. He shouldn't be punished because of my relationship with my son.
I know. What she also knew was that Jean-Guy Beauvoir wasn't some replacement for their son. His relationship to Armand was far different, far older. It seemed almost ancient, as though the two had known each other for lifetimes. They belonged together.
Daniel loves you, Armand. She squeezed his hand. I know he does. Give him time.
Armand had dropped his head, then raised it. I'm sorry I was short with you. I just...
Oui.
As the years went by and the grandchildren were born, he and Daniel had grown closer. Armand wondered if becoming a father himself had softened Daniel toward his own father, made him forgive whatever trespass had happened. There was still, he could sense, a small distance. It was as though there was a thin strand of barbed wire between them, so that he could only get so close before feeling the jabs. But Armand kept trying, and the distance had diminished, until, finally, it was imperceptible, no larger than a slight crack in a teacup. Reine-Marie watched the two in the bistro, leaning toward each other, and she dared hope. Down the table, Jean-Guy and Annie were still talking with Stephen.
"What do you know, sir, about Luxembourg?"
"Luxembourg?" asked Stephen, leaning forward and checking his phone.
"You expecting a call?" asked Annie.
"No."
Just then their dinners arrived.
Merlu Breton for Stephen.
The tender white fish was surrounded by baby potatoes, grilled beets, and a delicate sauce.
"That's very light," said Annie,
as her massive steak frites arrived with its sauce béarnaise.
"I'm saving myself for the rice pudding," explained Stephen.
"There's a project in Luxembourg," said Jean-Guy, as his own steak frites arrived. "A funicular. But I'm having trouble understanding the engineering reports."
Stephen nodded.
"So do I. I don't even try anymore. When I invest in an engineering company or project, I just read the emails between the project managers and home office. They're much more illuminating."
He put down his knife and fork and looked at the young man.
"Has something in this Luxembourg project caught your interest?"
Jean-Guy frowned as he thought.
"No."
"You're sure?"
"Yes."
The steely blue eyes glared at Jean-Guy, and his mind went blank. It was like looking down the barrel of a shotgun.
"Then why are we talking about it?" demanded Stephen. "You must have learnt the dark art of banality from your former boss."
Annie laughed, and even Jean-Guy gave a snort of amusement as all three looked down the table. Armand was focused on Daniel and apparently hadn't heard. But Daniel had. Not the words, but the laughter. He shot a glance their way and realized they were looking and laughing at him. "So," said Daniel, breaking off his conversation with his father to speak to Stephen at the other end of the table.
"We know Mum and Dad came to see Annie and Jean-Guy. But what brings you to Paris?"
Armand felt the glancing blow, a flesh wound, but a wound nevertheless.
"I came to Paris for meetings," said Stephen. "Arrived yesterday. Timed it to be here when the baby arrives, I hope."
He placed his hand over Annie's, then gave Daniel a penetrating look.
"Your parents and I also came to see you and Roslyn and the girls."
And Daniel coloured, but did not apologize.
"Now," Stephen said, glancing around the table, "have I ever told you about how your father..."
"Planned to propose to Mom?" said Annie. "Never. What happened?"
Armand just shook his head and grimaced.
"A toast," said Stephen, raising his glass, "to the gates of hell."
They clinked glasses, and Stephen caught Armand's eye. There was amusement and genuine happiness there, Armand was glad to see, but also a warning. The old tripwire, the barbed wire, was still in place after all.
"Really,"
said Reine-Marie once the laughter died down, The better question is where your father took me for our honeymoon.
I assumed it was here in Paris, said Annie.
I think we should order dessert, said Armand, and tried to get Margot's attention.
No, not Paris, said Reine-Marie.
Manoir Bellechasse? Asked Daniel.
Rice pudding, anyone?
Asked Armand, putting on his reading glasses and lowering his head to the menu.
No, shall you tell them, or should I?
Reine-Marie asked her husband.
Why didn't we ever think to ask?
Annie asked her brother. Too busy laughing at the proposal, he said. Attention diverted. Now you have to tell us. But once again, their attention was diverted, this time by dessert. Daniel and Roslyn shared the huge portion of rice pudding with its drizzle of salted caramel. Annie ordered her own pudding and fiercely defended it from Jean-Guy, who ended up sharing Stephen's. Reine-Marie and Armand, too jet-lagged to eat anymore, just watched. When the bill came, Armand reached for it, but Stephen took it instead. It was one of the rare times Stephen picked up a bill, and Armand looked at him questioningly. But the elderly man just smiled and left, Armand could see, an enormous tip. The night air was refreshing after the warmth and close atmosphere of the bistro, and revived Armand and Reine-Marie a little, though both longed for their bed. By habit and silent agreement, the family headed south, crossing familiar streets, passing familiar shops, on their way to the Palais Royal. It was the walk they always took after dinner at Juvenile. It gave them the impression they were working off the meal they just had, though they could walk to Versailles and still not work off the rice pudding. Annie and Jean-Guy, Daniel and Roslyn were up ahead, pausing to look in shop windows. Armand and Reine-Marie were about to follow Stephen across Rue de Richelieu, when Reine-Marie asked, "What time is it?" Armand checked his watch.
"Almost 11."
They turned toward the Tour Eiffel, and sure enough, as they watched, it lit up in the distance, sparkling.
"Look at that," said Armand, with a sigh, tipping his head back.
Stephen paused on his way across the street and looked up from his phone. A delivery van, half a block away, had stopped to let him cross. It started to move, slowly. Then it picked up speed. Moving quickly now. Armand looked away from the glittering tower, just in time to see what was happening, what was about to happen. He raised his hand and shouted a warning. But it was too late. There was a thud, and the vehicle sped away. Jean-Guy took off after it as Armand ran to Stephen.
"Call an ambulance."
Reine-Marie stepped into the middle of the street, her arms up and waving, to protect Armand and Stephen from the oncoming vehicles. Armand fell to his knees, and turning to Daniel, he yelled,
"Help your mother!"
and watched as Daniel backed away.
"Mama!"
Annie screamed, and Armand turned just in time to see a car skid to a stop within a foot of Reine-Marie. So close, she put her hands on the warm hood.
"Reine-Marie!"
Armand shouted.
"I'm fine. I'm calling for help,"
yelled Annie. Armand turned back to Stephen. His hands hovered over the still body of his godfather, not daring to turn him over for fear of doing more damage, if that was even possible.
"No, no, no,"
he whispered.
"Please God, no."
He could see blood on the pavement, and Stephen's glasses and keys and shoes flung about. Stephen's legs were at an unnatural angle. His head was obscured by an arm. Armand felt for a pulse. It was there, light, wavering.
"Daddy?"
Annie asked, approaching her father and the body on the ground as the Tour Eiffel sparkled in the background.
"Get back," her father commanded. "Get off the road."
And she did.
"Armand?"
Reine-Marie knelt beside them as drivers got out of cars and gaped. A few honked, not realizing what was happening.
"An ambulance,"
Armand repeated, not taking his eyes off his godfather.
"On its way,"
said Annie and Roslyn together. Reine-Marie reached out and picked up Stephen's shattered glasses and keys and put them into her handbag. His shoes she left. Armand held Stephen's hand and bent close as two people could be, and whispered,
"I love you. Hold on. Help is on the way. I love you."
What can I do? Daniel asked, joining them.
Nothing, said his father, not bothering to look at him.
Chapter 4. The paramedics arrived within minutes and quickly assessed the situation. Armor stepped aside but remained close, watching as they took Stephen's vitals, carefully turning him over, fitting an oxygen mask on the bloody face. Renmarie slipped her hand into Armand's, feeling it sticky. There was no sign of life from the elderly man. He was completely limp.
He's alive, she whispered.
Armand nodded, but couldn't yet speak. He just stared at Stephen as the medics, who were communicating with the emergency doctor back at the hospital, used words both Armand and Jean-Guy had heard too often, about wounds too grave. Shock, hemorrhaging, probable skull fracture. Had this been a battlefield, Stephen Horowitz wouldn't have passed the triage. He'd have been left on the ground to die. It would not have taken long. The police arrived. Without leaving Stephen's side, Armand quickly introduced himself and said,
"This was no accident."
"What do you mean, sir?"
"The vehicle, a delivery van for a boulangerie, hit him deliberately. I saw it."
The officer paused in his note-taking.
"That's quite an accusation."
"I saw it too," said Renmarie.
"And you?"
The agent turned to Annie, Daniel, Roslyn, and Jean-Guy, who was still catching his breath after sprinting after the truck, then running back.
"It didn't stop," said Annie. "Did you get the plates?"
"I got a photo," Jean-Guy said, and showed it to the cop while the paramedics lifted Stephen carefully onto a gurney.
"That makes it a hit and run," said the cop, leaning close to Jean-Guy's phone. "But not attempted murder." "This is unusable, sir. I can't make out anything."
Jean-Guy looked at it himself and had to agree. It was just a blur.
"I'm a police officer in Quebec," said Armand. "This was a clear attempt on his life."
"Quebec?"
said the cop and lifted his brows. No need to ask what he was thinking.
"Yes. We're senior homicide investigators with the Sûreté du Québec," said Jean-Guy. "You have a problem with that?"
"Not at all, sir."
The cop made a note, then looked at Beauvoir.
"Did you actually see the vehicle hit the man?"
Jean-Guy bristled, but shook his head.
"Bon. Did any of you?"
Annie hesitated, then shook her head, as did the others.
"I told you, I saw it," said Renmarie, "and so did my husband. You have two witnesses."
"Your name?" She gave it. "It's Friday night. It's dark," said the cop. "The man's in a black overcoat. The driver might have had too much to drink. Don't you think it's possible?"
"It was deliberate."
Armand took out his card, scribbled his Paris mobile number on the back, and handed it to the gendarme.
"I'm going with him."
Armand followed Stephen into the back of the ambulance, and after a very brief argument, the paramedics relented, realizing there was no way they'd be able to get the man out.
"I'll let you know which hospital,"
Armand shouted to Renmarie as the door slammed closed.
"Will he be okay?"
asked Annie. Did she mean Stephen or her father? As the ambulance sped off, Renmarie took her daughter's hand, while Daniel put his arm around his mother's shoulder. All emergency waiting rooms looked the same, smelled the same, felt the same. They'd taken Stephen to the Hôpital Hôtel Dieu on Île de la Cité, almost in the shadow of Notre Dame. Armand stared at the swinging doors where the paramedics had rushed Stephen, and which now separated Armand from his godfather. He could have been anywhere, in any hospital, in any city. Time, place, did not exist here, did not matter here. The others in the room, waiting for news of their loved ones, looked gaunt with anxiety and exhaustion, and boredom. Armand had washed the blood from his hands and face, but couldn't get it off his clothes. They'd be thrown away, he knew. He never wanted to see them again. It was ridiculous to blame the shirt and tie, the jacket and slacks for what had happened. But even the socks would be tossed out. He'd called Renmarie first to let her know where they were. She'd arrive soon. He suggested the others return home and wait for news. Then he'd called his friend.
"I'll be right there, Armand."
Reine-Marie arrived within minutes, with Annie and Daniel. Jean-Guy and Roselyn had returned home to the children.
"Any news?" Reine-Marie asked, taking Armand's hand.
"None."
"He must be still alive," said Daniel.
He put his hand on his father's arm. "Oui." Armand gave his son a thin smile of thanks, and Daniel dropped his hand.
"Armand," came a voice from the entrance.
A slender man in his late 50s and wearing clothes clearly just thrown on walked rapidly toward them, his hand out.
Armand took it. "Merci, mon ami. Thank you for coming. Reine-Marie, you remember Claude Dussault?"
"Of course."
Dussault kissed her on both cheeks and looked at her gravely, then turned to the others.
"These are our children, Daniel and Annie," Armand said. "Claude is the prefect of police here in Paris."
"This is a terrible thing to happen," said Monsieur Dussault.
He shook their hands, then turned to Armand, noting the bloodstains and exhaustion.
"How is he?"
"No word," said Armand.
"Let me try."
Dussault went over to reception and a few moments later returned to them.
"They let us in, but only one of you."
"We'll stay here," said Reine-Marie.
"Go home," said Armand.
"We're staying," she said.
It was the end of any discussion. As he went through the swinging doors, Armand felt himself light-headed for a moment, swept back into memory, as blood-stained sheets were drawn over the faces of officers, young men and women he'd recruited, trained, led, whose birthdays and weddings he'd danced at. He was godfather to several of their children. And now they lay dead on gurneys, killed in an action he'd led them into. He'd had doors to knock on then, eyes to meet and lives to shatter. He took a ragged breath and kept walking, through those memories and into this new nightmare. His friend and colleague by his side.
"He's in one of the operating theatres," said Claude, after speaking with a nurse. "We should make ourselves comfortable."
They sat side by side on hard chairs in the corridor.
"Terrible place,"
whispered Dussault, clearly struggling with his own memories of his own young gendarmes.
"But they do good work, if someone can be saved."
Armand gave a curt nod.
"On the way over, I looked up the preliminary notes of the flic who responded to the call."
The préfet had used the Parisian slang for cop, les flics, learned on the streets before he'd joined the force. Though it was not, strictly speaking, a compliment, most cops, between themselves, had adopted the word. Originally from Yiddish slang, flic had become a sort of term of endearment, or at least of camaraderie. Armand remained silent, his focus on the door leading to the operating rooms.
"He wrote that you said it was deliberate. Do you believe that?"
Now Armand turned to him, his eyes bloodshot with exhaustion and emotion.
"It was. The vehicle was stopped. Then it sped up. It meant to hit Stephen."
Dussault nodded, looked down at his hands briefly, then back up.
"The other witnesses agree that the van left the scene. One of them, your son-in-law, I believe, got a very bad photo of it."
"Reine-Marie also saw it speed up to hit Stephen."
"Did she? After you left, she described what happened. She said you were both looking at the Tour Eiffel that had just lit up."
"That's true. I began to speak to Stephen."
Armand stopped and blanched, suddenly feeling he might be sick.
"What is it?" asked Claude.
"I didn't realize Stephen was in the middle of the street. When I spoke, he stopped and turned. He didn't see the van. Couldn't. He was looking at me."
"This isn't your fault, Armand,"
said Claude, immediately understanding what he was saying, feeling. The swinging doors opened, and a nurse came through.
"Monsieur le préfet?"
he asked, looking from one to the other. The two men stood up.
"Oui," said Dussault.
"Mr. Horowitz is alive?"
Armand's face opened with relief, but the nurse hurried on.
"But he's in critical condition. We honestly don't know if he'll survive the surgery. And even if he does, there's significant trauma to his head."
Armand bit the inside of his lip, hard enough to taste blood. Dussault introduced him as next of kin.
"You might want to go home," the nurse said to Gamache. "If you leave your number, you'll be called."
"I'll stay, if you don't mind."
"We'll stay," said Dussault,
and watched the nurse return through the swinging doors before he turned back to Gamache.
Horowitz? The injured man is Stephen Horowitz, the billionaire?
Yes. Didn't the report say that?
It must have. But I guess I was focusing on your statement.
He's my godfather. Excusez-moi. I'm going to tell Reine-Marie and the others to go home.
Claude Dussault watched Armand walk back down the corridor, sidestepping doctors and nurses as they responded to other emergencies. Once Armand had left, Dussault went over to the nurse in charge and asked for the bag of Stephen's things. Not his clothing, but whatever had been in his pockets. The prefect looked through the wallet, checking every slip of paper, then picking up the shattered iPhone and examining it. Replacing everything, he resealed the bag and gave it back to the nurse. Reine-Marie, Daniel, and Annie hurried to meet Armand. The others in the waiting room looked up, alert, afraid, then dropped their eyes when they realized he wasn't a doctor bringing them news.
"He's still in there," said Armand, giving Reine-Marie a hug.
"That's good news, right?" said Annie.
"Oui."
Her father's reply was so muted, she immediately understood.
"Dad," said Daniel, "I'm sorry."
"Merci. He's in good hands."
"Yes, but I want to say I'm sorry I didn't react when you asked for help. I think I was in shock."
Now Armand turned to his son and focused on him completely. If there was one thing the senior police officer understood, it was that everyone had strengths and weaknesses. The important thing was to recognize them and not expect something from someone who didn't have it to give. He knew he should never have turned to Daniel, not in that moment, not in a crisis. Not, perhaps, ever.
"You're here now," he said, looking into that worried face. "That's what matters."
"Do you think the driver meant to hit Stephen?" Annie asked.
"Well, yes."
"No, I mean, do you think he knew it was Stephen?" she clarified, her lawyer's mind working. "Or do you think it was a random attack?"
Armand had been troubled by that himself. He couldn't see how the driver could have specifically targeted his godfather. And yet, if it was a random terrorist attack, another one using a vehicle as the weapon, why hadn't the driver ploughed into them too? Why take out just the one elderly man?
"I don't know," admitted Armand.
He looked over his shoulder at the swinging doors.
"I need to get back. I'll let you know. I love you."
"Love you,"
said Annie, while Daniel nodded. Reine-Marie hugged him tight and whispered,
"Je t'aime."
Chapter 5. Once back in their apartment, Reine-Marie sank into a rose-scented bubble bath and closed her eyes, trying to get the filth of the events off her. She took in deep, soothing breaths and could feel her body relax, though her mind kept working, conjuring images. Of Stephen on the ground, of Armand's face, of the van speeding by, and the car coming straight at her. She'd stayed rooted in place, not leaping aside. If she had, the car would have hit Armand, and she'd be damned if she'd let that happen. And then another image appeared, the expression on the face of the officer, clearly not believing what she and Armand knew to be true. This was no accident.
"You okay?" asked Jean-Guy. "You must be exhausted."
He'd carried Honoré home, fast asleep in his arms, the two blocks from Daniel and Rosalind's apartment. After putting his son to bed, he'd waited up for Annie, texting her now and then short messages of support. Now Annie and Jean-Guy lay in bed as she tried to get comfortable. The lights out. Honoré's baby monitor confirming he was sound asleep. But sleep wouldn't come for the boy's parents. Annie was days away from giving birth, and Jean-Guy was worried this shock could be harmful.
"I'm okay. She's kicking. Must know I'm trying to get to sleep."
Jean-Guy smiled and cupped his wife and unborn daughter in his arms.
"Who's this friend your father called?"
"Claude Dussault," said Annie.
Jean-Guy sat up in bed.
"The prefect of police for Paris?"
"Yes. You know him?"
"Only by reputation. A good one."
"Dad met him years ago on an exchange program, when they were just agents."
She almost asked why he'd told that cop at the scene that he was a homicide cop in Quebec, when he wasn't. Or maybe, she thought, he was. Still. Always. But she didn't ask. As a lawyer, she was trained to never ask a question if she wasn't prepared for the answer. Instead, she said,
"That cop didn't believe that the van meant to hit Stephen."
"No."
"Do you?"
"Yes." It would not occur to Beauvoir to doubt Gamache. The question is, will this Claude Dussault believe it? It was the middle of the night, though they couldn't tell in the windowless, airless corridor. The activity just down the hall, where emergency cases first arrived, had not let up. Accidents, coronaries, strokes, victims of violence. There were screams of pain and shouts for assistance by medical personnel. Armand was beginning to recognize voices. There was the overwhelmed intern, the harried paramedics, the firm nurse, the cool senior doctor, and the janitor with his almost eerie whistle. The noise and activity had gone from a cacophony, jangling Armand's nerves and bringing back deeply unpleasant memories, to almost soothing in their familiarity. Armand found his eyelids heavy and his head falling back against the wall. It was 2:30 in the morning, and he hadn't slept for 2 days, since the overnight Air Canada flight from Montreal. Claude had found a vending machine and bought them coffee. Wretched, but welcome. But even that weak shot of caffeine couldn't keep him alert. Armand's head hit the wall and he jerked awake. Wiping his face with his hands, he felt the beginning of stubble, then looked over at Claude, who was reading. "You can go, you know. You have to be at work soon." Dussault looked up. "It's Saturday. The boss gave me the day off."
"You're the boss."
"Convenient, that. I'm staying." He lifted the tablet and said,
"The report from the responding officer mentions alcohol on your breath and that your eyes were bloodshot."
"I'd had 2 glasses of wine with dinner. I wasn't drunk."
"But with jet lag, it's possible it affected you more than you realized."
"It's been a while since I was drunk, but believe me, I know what it feels like. I was, and am, completely sober. And I know what I saw."
"You think that van meant to hit Stephen Horowitz?"
"Not just hit, kill. Not just think, but know." Dussault took a deep breath and nodded.
"Then I believe you. But it does raise some questions."
"Really?" said Gamache, and saw Dussault smile.
"I've assigned this to my second in command. She works out of the Quai des Orfèvres," said Dussault.
"She? I thought your number 2 was Thierry Girard."
Dussault shook his head. "Like your second in command, mine has also jumped ship. I think they just might be smarter than us, Armand. They're not getting shot at, and they're managing to make more in a year than I do in 5.
"Ah, but we have a dental plan," said Armand.
"Unfortunately, we need it. Still, I have an excellent replacement in Irena Fontaine. I'll arrange a meeting tomorrow morning."
"Merci."
"We'll keep the details and our suspicions quiet, of course. I had no idea you knew Stephen Horowitz."
"Know him," Armand corrected.
He knew he was being pedantic, but he needed to keep Stephen alive, even if it was just grammatically.
"He practically raised me, along with my grandmother."
Dussault was familiar with that part of Armand's life, so didn't need to dredge it up again. But he did have more questions.
"How did you meet him?" "He was a friend of my father's. They met at the end of the war. Stephen was acting as an interpreter for the Allies."
"He's German, isn't he?" There was, quite naturally, an assumption in that question.
"He was born in Germany, but escaped and came to Paris, worked with the resistance."
"Escaped, you say? Is he Jewish?"
"Not that I know of. More of a humanist, really."
Dussault was quiet, and Armand looked over at him.
"What is it?"
"Not that I'm doubting you, or him, but my father used to marvel how many men and women suddenly fought with the resistance when the war ended."
Armand nodded. "My grandmother used to say the same thing."
"I'd forgotten that she was from Paris."
"The Jewish quarter, Le Marais, yes. Before..."
But he left it at that.
"Stephen never spoke of the war. She did, but rarely.
Then how do you know he was in the resistance?
I heard my mother and father talking about him.
You must have been just a child.
I was. I didn't completely understand, of course. Later, Stephen told me that my father helped him get to Montreal and loaned him the money to start his business. When I was born, they named him as a godparent.
Awkward, for someone who doesn't believe in God.
I think maybe he believes, but is just angry, giving him the silent treatment.
Let's hope he doesn't get to meet him soon. I don't envy le bon Dieu.
Armand smiled at that and imagined Stephen, whole and strong, standing at the gates. But which gates?
Hell is empty, he murmured.
Pardon?
Asked Claude. Just something Stephen likes to say. Hell is empty, and all the devils are here.
Charming. But this is Paris, Armand, the city of light. No devils here.
Gamache turned an astonished face to his friend.
You're joking, of course.
He examined Dussault.
The terror was partly inspired by the Age of Enlightenment. How many Protestants massacred? How many men and women guillotined? How many Jews hunted and killed? How many innocents murdered by terrorists here in the City of Light would agree with you? There are devils here. You, of all people, know that.
Dussault had forgotten that his friend was a student of history, and, therefore, of human nature.
You're right, of course. Monsieur Horowitz has no family of his own?
Claude asked, bringing the topic back to the man fighting for his life just meters away.
Siblings?
Not that I know of. Stephen's family lived in Dresden.
No more needed to be said about that.
A wife? Children?
Armand shook his head.
Just me.
I have agents going over the CCTV cameras in the area. Since we know the time of the attack, we'll be able to find the van as it turned onto Rue de Rivoli.
And where Stephen was hit?
Claude shook his head. We can't put cameras on every block in Paris, so no, none on the small side street. But shopkeepers might have their own. They'll be canvassed as soon as stores open. But there's something I can't immediately get my head around.
Was Stephen the target, or was it random?
Yes. If this was an attempt on Monsieur Horowitz specifically, how did the driver know it was him?
And if it was random, a terrorist attack like the others using vehicles, why didn't the driver try to hit more people?
Said Gamache.
Us. We were as vulnerable as Stephen.
Yes. We are categorizing this as a hit and run. But,
he put up his hand to stop any protest,
treating it as attempted murder.
Claude Dussault looked at his friend and spoke the words Armand Gamache needed to hear.
I believe you.
Both men looked over as a doctor stepped through the swinging doors. Chapter 6. The moment she heard the creak of the front door, Reine-Marie was instantly awake and out of bed.
Armand?
Oui,
he said, whispering, though without knowing why. Reine-Marie switched on the hall light.
Stephen?
She asked as she embraced him.
Still alive.
Oh, thank God.
Though even as she spoke, she wondered if thanks were really owing.
How is he?
Critical. He's in recovery. They wouldn't let me see him.
How are you?
She looked into his haggard face and saw his eyes well. She grabbed him to her again, and they held on to each other, weeping for Stephen, for themselves, for a world where this could happen as they strolled happily along a familiar street. They stepped apart and wiped their faces and blew their noses, then Armand followed her into the kitchen. All the way home in the taxi, all he'd wanted to do was hug Reine-Marie, have a hot shower, and crawl into bed. But now he just sat at the kitchen table, staring ahead. Reine-Marie put the battered kettle on the gas ring and brought out the teapot. The kitchen was old-fashioned. They'd discussed updating it, but somehow it never got done. Probably because neither really wanted to change it. It was the same as when Armand's grandmother Zora was alive and had bustled around it, chatting away in her strange mix of Yiddish and German and French. She'd learned Yiddish and French growing up in Paris, and German in the camps. She'd left the apartment to him in her will, along with all she possessed, which mostly amounted to her love, which was plentiful, and which he carried with him always.
Nein, Obstel, Armand could almost hear her say. Stop. Tea always better when Wasser isn't quite bouillon.
You should know by now, she chastised him. Don't plot, he'd invariably reply, which amused her greatly. His grandmother was long dead, and now he watched Reine-Marie, brushing grey hair from her eyes, move about the kitchen. She brought the teapot over, nicely steeped, with a jug of milk from the cranky old fridge.
Merci, he said, stirring in sugar. They say he probably has brain damage, but at least there is activity there.
Reine-Marie sipped her tea. She knew Armand was thinking the same thing, but couldn't yet say it. When they finished their tea, Armand had a hot shower, turning his face into the water, tasting the salt from his face. Crawling into bed beside Reine-Marie, he fell immediately into a deep sleep. 3 hours later, he woke up, with light streaming through the lace curtains. In the first flush of consciousness, he felt completely at peace, here in this familiar apartment, surrounded by familiar scents that evoked such a deep contentment. But a second later, he remembered and immediately reached for his phone, checking for messages. There was none from the hospital. Reine-Marie was already up. She'd been out to the shops along Rue Rambuteau and brought back fresh croissants from their favourite patisserie, Pain de Sucre. He followed the scent of strong, rich coffee into the kitchen and saw cheese and raspberries and ripe pears on the table, along with the croissants and a pain au raisin, bought with Stephen the day before.
Up already? She asked. How did you sleep?
Well, very well, he said, kissing her. Not long, but deeply.
Nothing more from the hospital?
No. How are you?
I think I'm still in shock. I can barely believe it even happened.
He hugged her, then went off and showered again and shaved. As he dressed, he saw his clothing from the night before, tossed onto the chair. Even from across the room, he could see the blood. He checked again for messages, scanning for the one he dreaded, but it wasn't there. Surely the hospital would have gotten in touch if... Over breakfast, he called Daniel, then Annie. He'd texted them the night before with an update, but wanted to find out how they were. Jean-Guy got on the phone.
Any word from the cops?
No, I'm just about to call.
Are they treating this as attempted murder?
Yes.
Jean-Guy heaved a sigh.
Thank God for that. What can I do?
You talked to Stephen last night more than I did. Did he say anything at all that might be important? Anything he was working on or worried about?
Annie and I have been going over our conversation with him. There was nothing.
In the background, Armand heard Annie call,
The phone! Tell him about the phone!
Oui.
He did keep checking his phone, like he was expecting a call or message.
Huh,
said Armand. Stephen normally despised it when people brought out their phones over a meal, never mind actually used them.
How did he seem to you? Armand asked.
The usual, in a good mood.
What did you talk about?
Nothing, really. Well, Jean-Guy gave a small laugh, I mentioned a project at work, and he seemed interested, but then accused me of wasting his time.
Armand took that in. He'd also been going over their conversation at the Musée Rodin, and while Stephen had seemed his old self, there was that strange moment when talking about the devils.
Not here, he'd said, leading Armand to think Stephen knew where they were.
He wished now he'd pressed more, but it had seemed so innocuous. And then there was Stephen's comment that he wasn't afraid to die. Armand hoped that was true, but now he also saw something else in it. Not that his godfather was prescient, but that Stephen actually knew something.
If this was deliberate, Jean-Guy asked, who would do it?
Stephen made a lot of people angry, said Armand.
You think this was revenge?
Or a preemptive strike, hitting him before he hit them.
Mrs. McGillicuddy would know if Stephen was planning something, said Jean-Guy.
Damn, thought Armand, Mrs. McGillicuddy, I should have called her last night. She was Stephen's long-time secretary and assistant. He looked at his watch. It was 6 hours earlier in Montreal, which made it 1 a.m. Let the elderly woman have a few more hours of peace, he thought, before the anvil dropped. Besides, he'd have more news on Stephen's condition by then. After saying goodbye to Beauvoir, he called Claude Dussault.
We have these CCTV images, said the prefect. The van was a delivery truck reported stolen early in the evening. We have it turning onto Rue de Rivoli right after Monsieur Horowitz was hit. From there, it crossed Pont de la Concorde to the left bank and headed southeast, but the van disappeared into back streets. We'll find the vehicle, I have no doubt. How much it'll tell us is another matter. Any more word on Monsieur Horowitz's condition?
Not since last night. We're heading over there now.
Armand, the prefect hesitated. After some sleep and time to reflect, do you still think it was a deliberate attempt on Monsieur Horowitz's life?
Yes.
It was a clear answer, and the one Dussault had expected. But Gamache's insistence and his involvement were both unsettling and problematic.
It must be revenge, said Dussault. How many companies and individuals did he ruin in his career?
They ruined themselves. He just caught them. He was one of the first to figure out what Madoff was doing and alert the SEC.
And Enron, I think.
Yes. Ken Lay had been a personal friend. But that didn't stop Stephen from testifying against him. Believe me, it gave Stephen no pleasure. But he did it.
A sort of avenging angel. Is there anyone he was targeting now?
Not that I know of. I think he was mostly retired.
Dussault sighed.
Okay. Do you know what brought him to Paris?
He said he was here mostly for the birth of Annie's baby, but he mentioned he had some business early in the week. In fact, he was meeting someone for drinks before dinner.
But you don't know who?
No, he didn't say. Do you know if his phone was found?
I haven't seen mention of it. He's probably at the hospital with his personal effects.
I'll look for it when we get there.
I'll put a guard on Monsieur Horowitz's room, said the prefect. When you finish at the hospital, come by the 36. I'll be here all day.
The 36 was the nickname for 36 Quai des Orfèvres, where the Préfecture de Police traditionally had its headquarters. Most of the services had been moved to a new building, but some units and some people stayed behind. Claude Dussault, the head of all the forces, maintained an office there, mostly because he preferred the storied old building on Ile de la Cité to the modern one, and also because he could.
Taxi? Armand asked as they left their apartment.
I prefer to walk, if it's all right with you.
It was less than 10 minutes to the hospital, along streets he'd explored with his grandmother after she bought the apartment with the restitution money.
Those askools thought they could get rid of me,
she'd said triumphantly as she'd slapped down the money for the apartment.
Well, I'm back.
Young Armand did not need a translation. As they'd walked the quartier, Zora told him about her life in the Marais, when she was his age. She'd point out the synagogues, the parks, the old shops that used to be owned by friends of the family. All said in her cheerful voice, which somehow made it better. And worse. Now he and Reine-Marie left Le Marais, crossing the Pont d'Arcole and pausing to look at the restoration work being done on Notre-Dame. How long it takes to build something, he thought, and how quickly it can all be destroyed. A look, a harsh word, a moment of distraction, a spark. At the Hôpital Hôtel Dieu, they took the elevator to the critical care unit. Armand identified himself, showing his ID, and said, "We're here to see Stephen Horowitz."
"The doctor has asked if he can speak with you first," said the nurse.
"Of course."
They were guided to a private meeting room. Within minutes, a doctor appeared.
"Monsieur et Madame Gamache?" She motioned them to sit. "You're Monsieur Horowitz's next of kin?"
"I'm his godson. We were with him when it happened."
"You're named as next of kin on his Quebec hospital card."
"Which means you can tell us how he is."
"Yes, and you can make medical decisions. There's significant trauma. Honestly, a man his age should not have survived. He must be very strong.
Strong-willed, for sure, said Renmarie, and the doctor smiled.
He is that, she agreed.
Unfortunately, if will to live was all it took, most of us would never die.
She looked at them for a moment.
We have him in a medically induced coma. He's in no pain that we know of. We're monitoring him closely. Since he survived the night, there's a chance he'll go on.
Armand noticed she didn't say recover. She confirmed his suspicions a moment later.
You must prepare yourself for a difficult decision.
She looked into those thoughtful eyes. They were deep brown, and she could tell this was a man who'd had to make many difficult and painful decisions, who'd known pain himself. That much was etched into his face, and not just by the deep scar at his temple. She'd seen wounds like that before, when working emergency, and she knew what must have made it. She looked at him with more interest. Yes, there was pain in that face, but now she saw other lines. This man also knew happiness. And by the way he and his wife held hands, likely, they knew love. She was glad. They'd need it. Can we see him, please?
Yes, but only one of you, and briefly. We have some papers for you to sign, and there are his personal effects. Best to take them with you, for safekeeping.
I'll get those, said Renmarie as they stood up, while you see Stephen.
There's a gendarme outside Monsieur Horowitz's door, said the doctor. I understand there's some concern that this was no accident.
Yes. They left Renmarie to sort Stephen's things, which arrived in a sealed cardboard box, while Armand was taken down the quiet hall to a private room. The gendarme, at a word from the doctor, let him pass. Opening the box, Renmarie shoved aside the blood-stained clothing cut off by the emergency room medics, then opened the sealed plastic bag. Stephen's iPhone was there, smashed. She tried it. It was dead. There was loose change, and mints, and a handkerchief. His wallet had €305, and credit cards. She was about to close the bag when she remembered the things she'd picked up from the street the night before. Reaching into her handbag, Renmarie placed Stephen's broken glasses and keys into the bag. Then, pausing, she took a closer look at the keys. Last night, in the darkened panic, they hadn't struck her as odd. Now, in daylight and relative calm, they did. In fact, far more than just odd.
Chapter 7
I'm sorry, madame, I can't let you in.
Renmarie stared at the young man guarding Stephen's room.
Please,
she gave him her most matronly smile.
I just need to speak with my husband.
These are not the droids you're looking for, she thought, and almost shook her head. Jean-Guy had clearly rubbed off on her.
The young flick examined the woman standing in front of him. Her tone said, I'm your mother's age and harmless. But her eyes were far too intelligent to fool the agent. Besides, his mother had much the same eyes, and she was a judge on the French Assize Court. She'd taught him never to underestimate anyone, especially a smart woman. He smiled back and made a decision, recognizing that sometimes common sense needed to prevail. He'd also learned that from his mother. For common sense, he opened the door. For his training, he went in with her. Renmarie paused, unable for a moment to go beyond the threshold. Stephen was breathing with the aid of a machine. There were monitors and drips. His body seemed to be wrapped from head to toe in bandages, including over his eyes.
How could this man still be alive? She thought.
But it also brought flooding back, catching her up and tumbling her around, memories of seeing Armand in much the same condition. She took a sharp breath in and recovered herself. Armand sat beside the bed, his reading glasses on. With one hand he held Stephen's hand, in the other he held a copy of that morning's Le Figaro. Energy stat is down 3 points to 134.9. Produit Cassini is up half a point to 87.6. He was reading the report from the Bourse de Paris to Stephen.
as though it was a fairy tale for his grandchildren, giving each an inflection, a drama. The young gendarme stopped just inside the door and stared. It was a tableau so intimate he felt as though he'd violated these people by his presence.
Amo?
Reine-Marie approached the bed. He looked up, clearly surprised to see her.
I've found something, she said quietly.
Getting up, Armand kissed Stephen on the forehead and said quietly,
I'll be back soon. Don't go anywhere. I love you.
The box with Stephen's belongings was placed on the table by the window in the hospital room. Armand went through the contents as Reine-Marie watched, interested to see if the same thing struck her husband. Armand went first to Stephen's suit jacket, stiff with blood, and did something unexpected. Turning it inside out, he searched and, with a smile, withdrew a Canadian passport.
Stephen had his passport stolen many years ago, Armand explained, holding it up. Since then, he's had his tailor put in the hidden pocket. He keeps his important things in there.
Armand brought out one more thing, a slender agenda. He then went through the things in the box, all predictable. Except, his brow furrowed. There, lying amid the other items, was a key. Not an apartment key, but a room key.
Hotel Georges V, he read.
Yes, said Reine-Marie. That's what I wanted to show you. It was on the pavement. I picked it up last night along with his glasses and put them into my purse. I forgot they were there until just now. Why would he have that? He's staying in his apartment, isn't he?
Yes. I walked him there yesterday afternoon, and here's the key to his apartment.
Armand held it up, then went back to the hotel key.
Do you think someone else is staying at the hotel? She suggested. Could it be...
A lover? Asked Armand.
Ruth?
Said Reine-Marie. Armand felt a frisson. That might explain the here. The devil was in the Georges V. He smiled at the thought. Ruth Zardo, Stephen's friend, was also their close friend and neighbour in their Quebec village of Three Pines. An elderly poet, she was embittered, often drunk, definitely nuts, and brilliant. You were a moth brushing against my cheek in the dark. I killed you, not knowing you were only a moth with no sting. She and Stephen had proven a good match and fast friends, and while often angry, she was no devil. Perhaps, he'd often thought, just the opposite. Armand could still see her waving goodbye with one raised finger. So, who was in room 815 at the Georges V?
I guess it's possible the key was already there, said Reine-Marie, that someone dropped it and I picked it up by mistake.
Possible.
Armand pocketed the key and put the rest back in the box, with the exception of Stephen's agenda, which he also slipped into his pocket.
Let's find out.
The taxi pulled into the entrance to the luxury hotel. A man in livery opened the door and escorted them in. Armand gave him a 20-euro note, and the man bowed and backed away. The marble lobby was chock-full of fresh flowers, in banks and sprays, reaching almost to the 20-foot ceiling. It was like stepping into a forest of blooms.
Keep walking, Armand whispered to Reine-Marie, their feet echoing on the marble floor. Look like we belong.
She smiled at him, then caught the eye of a uniformed bellhop, and, nodding, she swept right by her with a casual bonjour, as though she was an habitué. Armand still carried the cardboard box from the hospital, but walked with such authority no one challenged them. Mercifully, they had the elevator to themselves and could relax. But Reine-Marie suddenly turned to Armand.
Have you told Mrs. McGillicuddy?
Not yet. I've emailed and asked her to call me when she can.
She's going to be devastated.
Agnes McGillicuddy had been Stephen's private secretary for 56 years. Now in her mid-80s, she'd refused to be rebranded an assistant and lorded it over the outer office like a hound of hell. She was married to Mr. McGillicuddy, he of no fixed first name. Sometimes Stephen called him Jeremiah, sometimes Josephat, sometimes Brian. Armand was never sure if he did it because he really didn't know Mr. McGillicuddy's name, or to annoy Mrs. McGillicuddy, though she refused to rise to it. They had no children, and despite the fact Stephen was actually older than she treated him like a son. The Gamashes knew her well, though neither had ever actually seen her away from her desk. When they got to room 815, Renmarie knocked once, then again. A chambermaid came down the hall, looked at them, then walked right by. Armand quickly unlocked the door, saying, "Hurry, she's going to call security. We don't have much time."
"Allô?" Renmarie called once the door closed behind them.
Silence. This was no normal hotel room. It wasn't even a normal suite. It was practically a castle within a castle. "You take down here," he said. "I'll go upstairs. Hurry, they'll be here soon."
"There's an upstairs?"
But Armand was already halfway up the curving stairway. While vast, the main floor didn't take long to explore. It was essentially one palatial room with a sitting area in front of a fireplace and a long, polished dining table under a Murano glass chandelier. A powder room was just off the entrance and a kitchenette tucked away at the back. In case the billionaire wanted to make his own dinner, she thought. The only cooking she'd seen Stephen do was open a tin of cashews, and even that was a struggle. Though she did notice a paper bag on the counter. Opening it, she saw one croissant. Newspapers sat by one of the armchairs, with a book called The Investment Zoo on top of them. There were signs not just of occupation, but of someone having settled in. Renmarie found Armand in a small upstairs study, rifling through the desk. "Stephen's definitely staying here," he said, looking up briefly. "His things are in the bedroom. But I think someone else is, too. There's another bedroom with an unopened suitcase. Can you see what you can find?" The second bedroom was larger than most Paris apartments. She went straight to the bag, really more a carry-on than a suitcase, and quickly went through the contents. Toiletry kit, a suit, silk tie, two clean white shirts, underwear and black socks. Fine handmade leather shoes, pyjamas, and a book. She searched for something to identify the owner, clearly a man, probably older, judging by the style of suit, not planning to stay long. Whoever this belonged to hadn't had time yet to unpack. There was an ensuite with hotel toiletries, but nothing else. She froze as she heard a chime, the doorbell. They'd run out of time. Armand appeared at the door to the bedroom. "They're here. Can you stall them?"
"You keep going,"
she said, heading down the stairs as the chime sounded again. It was cheerful and discreet, but to her it sounded like a shriek. She was halfway down when the door opened.
"Bonjour," a man's voice called out. "Monsieur Horowitz?" "It's the duty manager. Is there anyone here? Is everything all right?"
A middle-aged man stepped into the suite and stopped when he saw her.
"Who are you?" he asked.
Two large men in beautifully tailored suits and wearing earpieces stood behind him. They looked out of place in the almost effete surroundings, like street fighters at a tea party. Georges Cinq was home to many wealthy and powerful people. Clearly there was need of a security presence, and not a very discreet one.
"My name is Renmarie Gamache," she said, slowly walking down the last few steps. "I'm a friend of Stephen Horowitz. I'm afraid he's been in an accident."
"I'm sorry to hear that. Is he all right?"
"He's in the hospital."
"There was a man with you. Where is he?" the manager asked, trying to get around her.
Renmarie stood her ground, blocking their way.
"I've told you who I am. Who are you?"
The man, a little taken aback, said, "I'm the duty manager."
"Yes, but what's your name? I'm going to have to see your ID before I let you in."
He seemed reluctant to give it, then relented.
"Auguste Panier."
He showed her his hotel identity card, which she studied at some length.
"I don't want to be rude," she eventually said, handing it back. "But what are you doing here?"
Now the manager was really stumped. This woman was clearly a trespasser, yet she acted like she not only belonged, but owned the place. He was, perforce, a judge, if not of character, then clothing. He quickly took in her bearing, her good quality slacks, silk scarf, elegant autumn coat. Her style was classic, her eyes intelligent. And yet she was hiding something, he knew. Someone, to be more precise. He was about to repeat his question when they heard footsteps on the stairs and a man appeared. Middle-aged, distinguished, in a good suit, tie, shoes polished, well-groomed. He, too, looked like he belonged here. The only things out of place were the cardboard box he carried and the worn leather satchel over his shoulder.
"Bonjour," said Armand. "We're sorry to have just let ourselves in, but as my wife said, Monsieur Horowitz has been in an accident, and we wanted to collect some things for him."
Armand did not offer his hand, preferring to appear cordial but aloof, an attitude he'd observed in his godfather more than once. But he did offer his name.
"My name is Armand Gamache."
"And who are you to Monsieur Horowitz?"
"A close friend."
"I see. Shall we continue this conversation in my office?"
"If you wish," said Armand. "I hope you understand," said Monsieur Panier, once in his large mahogany-panelled office behind reception, "but I would like to see what you have taken from this suite."
Armand placed the satchel on the desk and unzipped it. Inside were pyjamas, a dressing gown, toiletries. Satisfied, the manager then nodded to the box.
"Unfortunately, I can't show you this," said Armand. "It's from the hospital and contains Monsieur Horowitz's belongings. As you see, it's sealed, and we need to keep it like that so that when he recovers, he knows nothing has been tampered with. It's for his protection and ours."
Armand made it clear the "ours" now included the duty manager. There was a moment's awkward silence. In fact, as well as Stephen's things from the hospital, Armand had swept the contents of the desk, including the laptop, into the box. As Reine-Marie stalled them down below, he'd resealed it, then quickly gone into the bedroom and thrown clothes into the satchel.
"I'm afraid I'll have to insist," said Monsieur Panier. "And I'm afraid I can't do that."
"Is there a problem?"
A new voice came from the door. Panier practically shot to his feet.
"No, not at all."
A woman stood partway into his office, and Gamache knew he was now looking at the real boss. She stepped forward, her hand out.
"Jacqueline Bellon, I'm the general manager."
They introduced themselves, and Monsieur Panier briefly explained the situation. Madame Bellon listened quietly, waiting until he'd finished, then turned to the Gamaches.
"I'm so sorry to hear about Monsieur Horowitz. I expect Monsieur Panier here has extended the sympathies of the hotel."
The Gamaches looked at him. Then Reine-Marie turned back to the general manager.
"Yes, thank you. He's been most gracious."
They could hear Monsieur Panier exhale. There was a slight arch of surprise and appreciation to Madame Bellon's brow, but that was all.
"You're a relation of Monsieur Horowitz's?"
"His godson," said Armand.
Her eyes dropped to the box.
"I'm afraid Monsieur Panier is right. We'll need to see what's inside there, too. I hope you understand."
And to be fair, Armand did. Thieves took all shapes and sizes. At luxury hotels, they were more likely to look like the Gamaches than a street thug.
"It's sealed by the hospital," Armand said, "and I want to keep it that way. But if you'd feel better calling the prefecture, you might try..."
Armand handed her a card. "Him." Madame Bellon's eyes widened.
"You know Monsieur Dussault?"
"I do. Clearly you do, too."
"He was here just yesterday. A friend of yours?"
"And a colleague, oui. I'm the head of homicide."
Gamache decided there was no need to specify his territory.
"Armand," said Reine-Marie, "we should get his things over to him."
"I'm afraid there is," the general manager said, "a small issue of his bill."
Armand almost smiled. It was a brilliant move on Madame Bellon's part. If they were thieves, they would not be at all happy about handing over a credit card.
"Of course." Armand placed a credit card on the duty manager's desk. "I believe he checked in 2 nights ago.
"Non, monsieur," said the manager, consulting his computer to confirm. "Monsieur Horowitz arrived 10 days ago. He was supposed to leave this coming Wednesday."
"Are you sure?"
asked Renmarie. Positive. Should we hold the room for him?
If you don't mind, said Armand.
The suite, said the manager, is €3,500. Renmarie and Armand exchanged a glance. They could certainly cover that.
A night.
Renmarie's face remained composed, though she could feel her blood and her children's inheritance draining away.
2 weeks. That would come to...
It comes to €49,000, said Monsieur Panier.
So far. That is, of course, before tax and any other charges. Monsieur Horowitz often had meals in his room.
Renmarie did a rough conversion in her mind. About $75,000. So far.
Given these circumstances, said Madame Bellon, all we'd need is a 10% deposit.
Avec plaisir, said Armand, as though they'd expected it to be more. I understand someone else is staying there. Can you tell us who that is?
The manager frowned.
No, Monsieur Horowitz was alone in the suite.
Are you sure?
Asked Renmarie.
Quite sure.
I'd like you to cancel the old keys, said Armand, handing back the key he had, and have new ones issued, please.
They did. As they left, Renmarie whispered to Armand,
You're going to have to get a paper route.
You're going to have to sell a kidney.
She smiled.
Should we at least stay here if we're paying?
Would you like to?
She thought about it.
No, I prefer our apartment.
Moi aussi.
Where to now?
She asked, and got the answer as Armand gave the taxi driver the address.
5 rue Récamier, s'il vous plaît. It's in the 7th arrondissement, across from the Hotel Lutetia.
Stephen's apartment. Armand sat back, the box on his knees, the satchel sitting on the seat between them. The magnificent houseman buildings glided past, but he was lost in thought. While he definitely liked the finer things, Stephen was notoriously careful with his money. Some might even say stingy. There was no way he would have paid for a suite at the Georges V when he had a perfectly good, even luxurious apartment in Paris. And yet it appeared that's exactly what Stephen had done. Now, why was that?
Chapter 8
Armand put his arm out and stopped Renmarie from going any farther. They'd let themselves into the apartment and were standing in the wide foyer. The archway into the living room was off to their left. Renmarie, slightly behind her husband, couldn't yet see the room or the problem. But Armand could. He didn't speak. Didn't have to. She saw his body tense. He lowered the cardboard box and shoulder bag to the floor. Leaning forward, Renmarie saw what he saw. The living room was a shambles.
Armand,
she began, but stopped when he raised his hand, a clear signal for silence. He moved slowly into the room, Renmarie behind him. They stepped over and around overturned chairs and side tables, lamps and paintings. She bumped into his back when he suddenly stopped. Armand remained completely still for a few heartbeats. He was staring behind an overturned sofa, his face grim. When he crouched down, she saw. There was a man on the floor, face down, dead. She took a step back, blanching. Armand stood and looked around quickly. What he'd seen, which Renmarie had not, was that the man had been shot twice, once in the back, once in the head. The man was cold to the touch. It must have happened a number of hours earlier. But
there's a slight scent in the air. Can you smell it?
He whispered. She took a deep breath and shook her head. Then she caught it. Hardly there. Elusive. More a suggestion than a scent.
Try to remember it.
His voice was urgent, his eyes sharp, his whole being alert. Slightly citrusy, she thought, and sort of muddy. Not a perfume, a cologne. Definitely masculine. Not pleasant. It was disappearing, even as she tried to grasp it.
Is it his?
She whispered, not looking at the man again.
I don't think so. And it's not Stephen's.
So it was someone else's. and Reine-Marie immediately followed Armand's thoughts and understood his extreme alertness. Colognes, eau de toilette, didn't hang around for long. They might cling to clothes, but did not float in the air, certainly not for hours.